This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. With Election Day fast approaching, we're taking a look at some of the issues and races on the ballot this year. Among those is a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court. The General Assembly recently passed a law that makes the Supreme Court race partisan for the first time in years. They also eliminated judicial primaries, so now more than one candidate from each party may appear on the ballot. We spoke yesterday with incumbent Republican Barbara Jackson. She is running for a second term on the state Supreme Court. Challenging her are Republican Chris Anglin and Democrat Anita Earls. Chris Anglin will join us on the show tomorrow. Anita Earls is my guest today. She is considered to be the force behind the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, a nonprofit organization she founded in 2007. She served as its executive director through last year. Before that, she worked for the Clinton administration as Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights and spent 10 years as a civil rights attorney in Charlotte and is on our program now. Anita Earls, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You saw at a very young age a disparity, I guess, in how people of color were treated. Was that what drove you to the law and the legal profession?
Well, absolutely. My own personal experiences with growing up in a mixed-race family, when my parents met in Missouri and fell in love, it was illegal at that time for them to be married. My father's black, my mother's white. So they moved out to Washington State where legally they could be married. But that experience and really many others gave me a sense of how important it is that we have people who are willing to work towards that guarantee of equal justice under the law.
You tell us about the impact of the loss of your brother. You lost your brother, and that had an impact on your career path, right?
Well, that happened 12 years ago, so actually pretty far along in my career. I'd never, no one expects, no family expects that one of their members would be murdered, but my brother was murdered. And what was most stunning to me is that despite, and this happened in Washington State, but despite my efforts to work with the police and prosecuting authorities, they refused to prosecute the woman who killed him. And that was a really challenging circumstance for me because it really flew in the face of what I had believed and worked for my entire career. It flew in the face of this concept of equal justice under the law.
You worked civil rights cases for a decade in Charlotte while you were an attorney. What made you take your work nationwide with the Justice Department?
Well, I was with the Judge Chambers firm in Charlotte for 10 years when I got a call from then acting Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Bill Landley. He asked me to come and help the department get ready for the next round of redistricting because of my experience in redistricting cases, and then also gave me responsibility for the educational opportunities section, disability rights, and the chance to see how civil rights enforcement happens across the country. And to have an impact on federal policy was quite, a great opportunity.
Your nonprofit, the nonprofit you founded, the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, has filed multiple lawsuits related to North Carolina's voter ID requirements. Many of these cases are still in court. You want a seat on the state Supreme Court. You may see these cases. Can you act in an impartial way? Will you have to recuse yourself if they come to you when you're on the bench? Should you win?
Well, certainly any case that I participated in representing a party, I would recuse myself. The voter ID case in federal court, that's the court that ultimately ruled that the law that included a voter ID but also ended same-day registration, cut back early voting, a whole host of measures, that was heard in federal court, so that would not come before the state Supreme Court. I did represent a plaintiff in state court challenging the voter ID requirement, but that case was no longer necessary once the federal court invalidated the law.
We talked about this question with the incumbent yesterday when we talked to Barbara Jackson, who's on the Supreme Court. She is identified as a conservative and running as a Republican. You're running as a Democrat, and you're certainly, and the coalition is identified with many progressive causes. And so the question again is, as somebody who's been identified with so many causes that have a kind of political cast, Can we expect you to be a fair judge on the Supreme Court?
Well, my record goes beyond my advocacy for groups. And these are nonpartisan, nonprofit groups. So I've represented the NAACP, A. Philip Randolph Institute, Democracy North Carolina, League of Women Voters, groups and communities that actually are nonpartisan. But beyond that, I have also had professional experiences where I've been in a different role. So for 2.5 years, I served on the State Board of Elections when that was a 5-member board. I was appointed by Governor Bev Perdue, a Democrat, but I was part of the board that unanimously found Governor Mike Easley, also a Democrat, in violation of campaign finance laws. And similarly, we actually also fined Governor Perdue. So in that role, I understood that once I was sworn in as a member of the State Board of Elections, it was my job to apply campaign finance and election laws equally across the board, no matter what party affiliation the parties in front of us had.
What do you think about this change in the law that makes these races now, judicial races, partisan? In other words, you have to put the D or the R or the L after your name. Is that a good thing?
Well, my sense is that voters find the party label useful. And so to the extent that it gives voters more information, I think simply identifying how a candidate is registered is a good thing. What's not a good thing is the way that the General Assembly and other political actors have tried to politicize the courts overall. So that law was really, there were 5 laws passed by this General Assembly trying to impact the outcome of this Supreme Court seat. One of those laws was found to be unconstitutional. But the when we have the chair of the North Carolina Republican Party saying that his party should that they should impeach a Supreme Court justice that doesn't rule in their favor, that to me is inappropriately politicizing our courts and not standing up for a fair and impartial judiciary.
This week, the North Carolina Republican Party filed a campaign finance complaint against your campaign, accusing the campaign of illegally coordinating with an independent organization, NC Families First. And that was to produce and air a commercial that's running on TV stations throughout the state. I want to right now just play a little clip from that that campaign that they're talking about and talk with you more about this charge.
After my brother was murdered and the killer never prosecuted, I personally experienced what it means to not get your day in court. If we are going to protect families and make communities safer, we need equal justice under law.
So that's a clip from an ad that's currently running in support of Anita Earls, her bid for the state Supreme Court. She's my guest now. The ad at the center of controversy, the claim is that that was an outside group that paid for that ad and that you, the charges that your campaign illegally coordinated that with them.
My campaign did not coordinate with that group. We put a lot of material on our YouTube channel, on our website. Some of it has been picked up by Spectrum News. Some of it has been picked up by my opponents. Senator Steinberg has an ad out where he's using some of the footage that I put up on YouTube. I can promise you I didn't coordinate with him either. It is enormously expensive to run a statewide campaign. And I've been using every tool at my disposal to communicate with voters. And one tool is to post things on my website and on the internet, and that is the long and short of what I did.
Yeah, and I have to say, that's where we got that clip, so it is in the public domain. Anybody can take it and use it any way we want. That's the way we did it. So just in terms of a full disclosure, we were able to get that clip without any legal constraint. It's free and open to the public to use as they want. One of the issues in this election is the proposed changes to the state constitutional amendments. As some see this, the Constitution as inflexible, we shouldn't be tampering with it. Others say, no, it's a living document, we should. There are 6 constitutional amendments up for voter approval this campaign cycle. Is that too many?
Well, what I would say is that as a judicial candidate, if I'm elected, it's my role to enforce the law however it is written. And I do think that the General Assembly has the power to put constitutional amendments on the ballot, and it's really up to the voters to say whether they want those amendments or not want them. I do feel that I'm able to comment on the one amendment that impacts the administration of justice, and that's the amendment that would change how we appoint judges when there's a vacancy. But the others, I simply say it's up to the voters to decide whether they want to amend our state constitution or not.
What about the appearance in these judicial races? Again, we're going to put this question to each of the candidates. The question that the public is now beginning to wonder about the independence of the judiciary, that things have become so politicized now at every level of our courts that the public is losing confidence in the judiciary in general as a kind of third wing of the government. Are you sensing that at all?
Well, absolutely. And I think there's good reason for that. And the kinds of things I pointed to earlier about what our political leaders are saying, I think what I've learned, I've been doing voting rights work for 30 years. What I've learned most recently is that it's not enough to have the right laws on the books to protect our democracy. We also have to have elected officials willing to abide by norms of behavior that protect our democracy. And whether we have a fair and impartial judiciary at some level depends on the willingness of the judiciary to police itself, but it also depends on the integrity and the honesty of the people that we elect. And I put my record before the voters to say that I have a demonstrated record of standing up for what's right and for being fair and impartial.
One of the other issues, and I think topics that you have been standing up for years, is this question in our judicial system and in our penal system of implicit bias, which you have talked about. Talk about your sense of what role implicit bias plays in our system. But there's a second part to that, which is, how can you then, if you have to take cases that you think implicit bias was a part and you were judging a criminal case that came before you, what role would your understanding of implicit bias play if you were to look at a case on appeal?
Right. In understanding the role of implicit bias, I'm really following the lead of judges across the country and judges in our own state. So Judge Lou Trosh in Charlotte, for example, has spearheaded an initiative to examine the role of implicit racial bias in the juvenile justice system for several years now. I have seen how it's both what happens in the courtroom. So the implicit racial bias of a judge or caseworker or attorneys, juries, but it also plays a role in what our legal doctrines are. So there is a scholarly book, Implicit Bias and the Law, which looks at each area of law. So even in things like corporate law and trusts and estates and areas of the law that you might not think of have any kind of racial bias, they've looked at how decisions over time have incorporated racial bias. So what is our response to that? In terms of what happens in the courtroom, there is research learning about how our brains work and how we can counteract that. There are checklists that judges can use on the bench. We have doctrines already concerning when peremptory challenges are used to exclude African Americans from juries. So I think it's important that judges are informed about the role of implicit bias and that we work together as a profession and as a branch of government to try to counteract that.
I am talking with Democratic candidate for State Supreme Court, Anita Earls, today on The State of Things. Tell us more about ways in which this can be managed and perhaps improved in the court. What would be some of the steps that you would take? I mean, you talked about education, but how does that play out in terms of not only in the courtroom, but in policing in general? We'll stay within the criminal justice system.
Well, in terms of the administration of justice, which I can address most clearly, there are initiatives, as I said, in parts of the state that I think we can support and try to expand. So this is not really what I'm doing my function as a judge when a case comes before the court is to apply the law fairly and equally to the facts in that case. What I'm talking about now is what I can do as a justice outside of the actual ruling on cases. And we've seen this, you know, a number of initiatives. So Justice I. Beverly Lake, for example, established a commission on equal access to justice because he was concerned about the extent to which people are not able to have either have their day in court or get access to good legal advice. So and one of the first canons of the Code of Judicial Responsibility is that we work towards making sure that we have a fair and impartial judicial system. So I'm talking now not about how I rule in particular cases, but what I can do serving as a justice and in a leadership role. And there are other initiatives that other state court judges have worked on to try to make sure that the profession is aware and learns about the science behind the impact of implicit bias and together explore ways to improve our judicial system.
So this is usually the first question, but just in the interest of keeping things interesting, I'll ask you last. Why run for state Supreme Court?
I ran because I saw how important it is that we have a fair and impartial court to protect our civil rights. Through doing the redistricting and voting rights cases, I saw how the legislature was trying to take over our courts and also trying to take away from people the right to vote for judges. So I'm running to stand up for a fair and impartial court and to vindicate the right to vote.
Anita Earls, founder of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, a nonprofit geared at the protection of economically disadvantaged people, also a Democratic candidate for state Supreme Court. You can tune in tomorrow for a conversation with Chris Anglin, who is also running for that seat. He is a Republican, and he is running against the incumbent, Barbara Jackson, as well as Anita Earls. We'll talk with him tomorrow. Early voting has begun in our state. It runs through November 3rd. Anita Earls, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more about early voting and everything on our show at stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnuson, Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.